Blog Talk Radio.
And a happy good afternoon to you from Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a sunny summer day, and we are going to try and get something that didn't go so well last week right today. This is your host, John Gresham, for Military Monday, and I want to start the show by apologizing. We had some technical difficulties last week. It appears that they have been resolved. Our platform service, Blog Talk Radio, seems to have gotten their phone problems under control, and we are back on the air to redo what we started last week. And that is talking about pirates. And we are not talking about a Johnny Depp film or even the old Spanish Main. We are talking about here and now and today. You would have to be kind of isolated not to know that piracy is a big business today. The fact of the matter is, though, it's been a big business for a very long time. And we have been wanting to have a good discussion on the question of contemporary piracy and what's being done to combat it. And we have with us today, as we tried to do last week, a real expert on the subject. Author of a new book on piracy from U.S. Naval Institute, and the former commander of what is called CTF-151, which is the International Counter-Piracy Task Force, Rear Admiral Terry McKnight. And Terry, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir. I'm here. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, and let us hope that things go a little bit more smoothly this week.
Great.
And thank you for coming back. I appreciate your patience last week and that of all the listeners. And let's just jump right into this thing. How old a profession is piracy in your mind? I mean, you are the subject matter expert of the day on piracy. Talk to us a little bit about piracy in the classic sense.
Well, John, when I go out and speak on the circuit there, I always, you know, say that there's about three or four professions that have been with us since the beginning of time, and one of them is definitely piracy. And as long as ships go to sea, there will be pirates. You go back and look at the days of Julius Caesar; he was captured by the pirates. Saint Patrick was captured by pirates. And the history of our United States Navy is born, and the foundation of our Navy was built around the Barbary pirates. So the United States Navy has been involved with piracy for over 225 plus years, and is, like I said, as long as commercial ships go to sea, we will continue to have piracy. So the United States Navy is involved with it today. And the big area the last couple of years has been in the Gulf of Aden, right on the Horn of Africa, off the coast of Somalia. But we've seen a major, major tick in piracy in the Gulf of Guinea off of Nigeria. So it's going to be there, John, with us, and our maritime navies are going to have to contend with it for a very long time.
Socially speaking, what conditions create piracy? In other words, what around the Horn of Africa, in your mind, were the primary conditions that created an environment where piracy became a viable business for the people in that region?
Well, in the case of Somali pirates, which I have most of my experience in, is the fact that around 2005-2006 time frame, a lot of foreign countries and companies were coming there and close to the coastline off of Somalia and fishing, and you know, it became big business. And the story goes that the Somalis, that, you know, of course it's a failed state, they didn't have any coast guard, and they decided to take basically their business and their law enforcement into their own hand. So a group of people, you know, got together, they went to sea, and they started to hijack small fishing vessels. And you know, they would get ransoms, you know, $25,000-$30,000, and then some smart people got together and said, well, we can get $25,000-$30,000 for fishing vessels, let's go after merchant ships. So later on, they started to go after merchant ships, and the first ones they targeted, which were the World Food Program ships, that were basically transiting very slow, low freeboard type ships in close into the coast of Somalia. So they went after that. And then a key event happened. A vessel called the Golden Nori was hijacked, and they got over $1 million for it. And after that, things just took off. They said, if we can get $1 million for a vessel like this, we'll just go after bigger fish. And that's exactly what they did. And they continued to do that in late 2008, 2009. Piracy was basically out of control. And billions of dollars in ransom payments, armed security teams, forces and everything were being spent on piracy. But we've seen a great success over the last few years, and everybody's worked together with the support of the United Nations. Several coalition task forces and other government agencies have worked together, and the numbers in off the coast of Somalia have come down dramatically.
It almost sounds like the model of what happened when Somalia failed on dry land, of the militias grabbing relief supplies and other personnel, has kind of moved offshore in a lot of ways. It's the same kind of model of you go where there are things of value, and if you can use them, you use them. If you don't, you can ransom them, correct?
That's correct. What we saw when I was out there in 2009, basically the task forces were concentrated in the Gulf of Aden, and we started to have success, and the pirates figured out, well, there's still a lot of ships out there in the Indian Ocean, and so they changed their tactics a little bit and basically hijacked mother ships and used these as staging vessels to go out into the Indian Ocean in deeper water. And there's some great examples. Of course, the Maersk Alabama was out in the Indian Ocean, which was hijacked, and also the Sirius Star, which was one of the largest oil tankers ever captured by the pirates, and both of those were out in the Indian Ocean, and they just like I said, they changed their tactics and went to where the area of least resistance and found more ships,
finding a crack and niche and working in it. Now, most of our listeners probably don't understand that there are, in addition to the pirates and the merchant vessels, and of course the navies that try and control them, there's a fourth player in here that really has a huge say in how piracy both is fostered, prospers, and for that matter is fought, and that is the insurance companies. Talk a little bit about Lloyd's and the other insurance companies and their role in piracy.
Right, that's a great point. As we all know, the world is flat, and commerce out there drives the world. And insurance companies, let's be frank, are out there to make money. And they Lloyd's and some other very large maritime insurance agencies, but Lloyd's predominantly are protecting these ships, just like we have in the United States. Big auto insurances companies and everything. So they're protecting these ships, and they have to go out to. And basically, make sure that these ships aren't captured and everything. But they're making money, so the cost of cargo itself, rises. And if ships themselves, put security teams on there, they have to rate the insurance rates go up. So the insurance rates go up, and the insurance companies make more money. When I was doing some research on the book, there was a person that I interviewed that said that in the UN Security Council resolutions that they basically approved almost everything, but restricted the terms "don't pay the ransoms" because there were a lot of people putting pressure on and say, "Hey, we're making a lot of money off piracy, so we'd like to see it end, but we definitely don't want to see our profits go down." So the mention of ransoms themselves in the Security Council resolutions was deleted before they were approved by the UN Security Council.
Okay, and they also want to make sure that they get the people on the ships back as well. The cargo, obviously, they want to go ahead and protect and eventually get to its destination, but they also want to protect the people because that, the supply worldwide of merchant sailors, especially qualified to run very automated ships like the ones we have out there now, is not unlimited. It is a hard life, and these are very valuable people in their own right.
Right, and that's one of the biggest concerns when you sit and talk about these issues with the merchant companies. They say that if we do not pay the ransoms for anybody who's hijacked, then the sailors will not sail in that part of the world. And like I said, there's just not a lot of sailors out there. the complicated part right now is that you'll have a merchant ship, and it may be registered in the Marshall Islands. It may be flagged in Panama, and the crew comes from all over the world, whether Malaysia, the Philippines, you know, India. So you'll have a mix of a crew. And so to find the jurisdiction where somebody wants to go after and protect them, you know, is a complicated issue. In the case of the Maersk Alabama, it was a U.S. flagged vessel. They were all U.S. crew members. And so it was pretty easy. But that's not always the case for some of these ships that are hijacked out there.
And for those of you who might want to call in, ask the Admiral or myself a question, or both of us, or just make a comment, please feel free to call in at 347-945-7246. Again, that's 347-945-7246. Admiral, you and I, in all truthfulness to our listeners, you and I actually go back quite a few years. When I visited you on what was probably your first command at the time, a very fine amphibious ship by the name of USS Whidbey Island back about 1995, and you were part of an amphibious ready group that was getting ready to go out and take the 26 MUSOC on a long, long trip across the world, weren't you?
Yes, sir, and I remember that. I remember you came in, we sat in my stateroom and talked about the value of the amphibious force, and your book that came out on Marine, you know, still sits on my bookshelf at home. And it was a great addition to my library.
Talk a little bit about your own career. I mean, obviously, we know a couple of the highlights, command of a ship, command of a task force, but tell us a little bit about yourself and your Navy career.
Well, I graduated from the Virginia Military Institute and then went off up to Newport, Rhode Island for surface warfare officer basic training back a few years ago in 1978. And then, got out into the amphibious force, which I spent the majority of my time. And you know, just it was a very, very great career from the day I started. I just enjoyed going to sea, enjoyed the ships, enjoyed the sailors, and the leadership that it was provided, you know, was outstanding. Spent a lot of time on the East Coast and the West Coast sailing around on the amphibious ships, and then I got lucky. I got selected for command. My first command was USS Whidbey Island, great ship, and then came back to Washington for a few years, did a couple other tours, and then went out to command the USS Kearsarge, which is a LHD, which is one of the most capable ships that the Navy has in its fleet.
My favorite class of ships ever built. Absolutely one of the most comfortable and utilitarian ships in the world.
I couldn't agree more. I think we underutilize the capability that they have. I know they're not as big as a modern-day aircraft carrier, but they're the size of a World War II aircraft carrier, and the command and control and communications and things that it's capable of doing is just immense. And, you know, there's a lot in the press about aircraft carriers, but I tell you, my plug would, you know, if you can't afford those, you know, look at something like an LHD to get out there, and they can do just, you know, the same type of things. They're big. They got power projection. And they got presence. So I commanded Kearsarge, and we went off and did OIF-1, and I took General Natonsky and Task Force Taro over there to the Gulf, and then we came back and did a few shore tours, and I got selected for flag, commanded Naval District Washington, and then went out to command Expeditionary Strike Group 2 and did my first tour out there. We were forward deployed in 2007, the first part of 2008, in the Gulf, supporting piracy and some other missions out there, and then came back and in November 2008 got a call from Admiral Gortney, who was the commander of 5th Fleet at that time, said, "Hey, McKnight, you know, pack your bags, you're coming out here and to stand up the task force." And believe me, it was, you know, like I said, in 1978 we were chasing the Soviets, some big ships, big airplanes, and then I go out there and in the last part of my career, and I'm chasing a bunch of kids in a 35-foot skiff with two Yamaha engines, which was a lot of fun. And the other reason it was a lot of fun is working with the coalition navies that were out there, which, you know, we don't do that a lot, and the professionalism they provided to that operation was just superb.
Talk a little bit about Combined Task Force 151, CTF 151, where it came from, and what was the motivation behind it at the time when it was created.
Right. Well, like I said a little earlier, in 2008, the piracy was basically out of control. And the large maritime communities got together and said, hey, we've got to stop this. With the support of the United Nations and a couple of Security Council resolutions, we got together and said, okay, let's go out there and fight piracy. Of course, there's a lot of political activity that goes in setting up a task force that, you know, the Navy could have been out there by itself, but it was decided that we were going to do a coalition task force. The first task force that was out there was the Operation Atlanta, which was the European Union task force. They got on station in late 2008, and then we arrived in January of 2009. And my first ships in the task force, I had a British naval vessel, a Turkish ship came down, and the Absalon, which was from Denmark. So at any given time, I had four or five ships in my task force, and like I said, it was a great opportunity to work with the coalition forces, and the ships and the sailors and the Marines that they sent down there were just superb, and it was a great operation.
When you talk about having four or five ships, two important points. First, what kinds of ships and aircraft and other resources did you have at your disposal? I don't like over-focusing on hardware, but let's face it, I know from your book and our previous conversations, you had an intriguing set of things you could go and work the problem with. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. That's a great point. I was out there for a little over four months, and actually was shifted around to four ships when I was out there. The first ship I had was the USS San Antonio, and a great ship, another extremely capable vessel. We had some helicopters, and we had the medical support team on board. So very capable ship, but probably not the exact platform, you know, for out chasing pirates. And then, about a month later, shipped it to the Vela Golf, Aegis cruiser, and extremely capable, you know, can move fast. We had a helicopter with a radar on there, which was superb. And also in our task force at that time, we had a DDG, the USS Mahan, that had Scan Eagle on board. So at that time frame, I probably had the best mix. I had the Absalon, who was well-qualified in the Turkish ship, Gershon, was out there. And that was probably, like I said, at that time, the most capable that I ever thought that I had the forces out there to do. We also had P-3 Maritime Patrol aircraft flying out of Djibouti, so we had a well-situated task force. And that was the time when we actually caught the most pirates out there. A lot of times the navies that are coming out there, and they basically don't want to go out and apprehend the pirates. They're basically deter the pirates. We could spend a whole afternoon talking about the issues about apprehending pirates, but most of the nations that are out there are just to deter them and prevent the pirates from hijacking the merchant ships.
You just mentioned a system called Scan Eagle. Now, that is an unmanned aerial vehicle that can be based aboard a ship, in this case on the back of a guided missile destroyer. Talk a little bit about Scan Eagle and what it gave you in terms of capability that was useful in this situation.
Well, it's a great point, and as we, you know, more and more, and we see in operations not only at land but at sea today, are these unmanned vessels, aircraft. And Scan Eagle, it's a small, what they call UAS, and like you said, can fit back on the back of an amphibious ship or fit on the back of a DDG. They basically just catapult it out there. And this thing can stay out and basically fly around for, you know, 8 to 10 hours. And it's the person who's operating watching the video. There's a data link back to the ship. It can go out, you know, a couple hundred miles or so, keep a nice picture and give you a area surveillance of, you know, it can't be a wide area surveillance, but just enough area. If you have a target of interest or an area of interest, you can send it over there. And so it goes out there. You've got a guy back or a gal back on the ship, basically with a joystick and just maneuvering it around like you would, you know, would do video games. We used it extensively to fly over the pirate camps, merchant ships. So like I said, you could keep it up for, you know, 8 to 10 hours, and it was definitely a force multiplier when I was out there.
Now, you just brought up a point a couple minutes ago that you'd rather deter the pirates from actually attacking as opposed to having to deal with them and then have to capture them and you know, what do you do with them? I'm guessing that based upon what you just said, you probably had a very busy JAG or legal officer and some sort of diplomatic liaison trying to deal with how you dispose of these pirates.
Right. I mean, like I said, it's a three beer story on dealing with them. And I had a great legal team and law, and I want to say law enforcement team. My JAG officer was a guy named Pete Kobler, who just did an outstanding job. I also had a law enforcement detachment from the USS Coast Guard. I had NCIS agents, and I had other people who were assisting, you know, on the ships that, you know, when we actually apprehended the pirates and their material, make sure we had the right material to provide for trial. The problem that you have out there, John, is if they're going to attack a U.S. Navy warship, the U.S. will basically take jurisdiction and, you know, and take them to court, like we've seen several times in the case of the Maersk Alabama, and then the famous case of the sailing vessel Quest, who they just had three sailors convicted down in a court in Norfolk, attacking and killing some sailors out there. The problem that you run into, like I said earlier, it may be a flag vessel from the Marshall Islands, and it may be registered in Panama, and there's a mix of crew. So who takes jurisdiction over them? So if you can't get the host nation to take jurisdiction, then you have a problem. I always tell the story that one time the Absalon, which was a Danish ship, captured some pirates that were attacking a Dutch merchant ship, and the Netherlands agreed to prosecute them. So we had to get these pirates back to the Netherlands for prosecution. So it was decided that the Absalon would go into port into Bahrain and offload them and fly them out to a plane. The Bahraini government was very supportive, but said basically we don't want the Absalon to come into port until they're ready to fly out. So they sat at anchor for a couple of days, and finally they got the tickets and the diplomatic security and everything all ready to go. And so they come into the Absalon, comes into port, and the they take them on in a van, drive them down to the Bahraini airport, you know, walk them through the airport, get them on the jetway there, and it just happens to be that the pilot standing there is these suspected pirates come on board the plane, and of course he turns and says, "Who are these people?" And then the security people say, "Well, they're suspected pirates. We're getting them back to the Netherlands." And he said, "Well, they're not coming on my plane." So now it's all over the press. They had to back them off and go in there. So it's a very complicated process. When we were out there, we had a memorandum of understanding with Kenya that they would prosecute a certain amount of pirates. Well, once we started capturing pirates and sending them to Kenya, their courts got overwhelmed. So they basically said, "Look, we can't do it right now." So we've had some other nations that have agreed. The Seychelles have agreed to prosecute them. But it's a rough area out there, and we just want to make sure that if they are captured and they're going to be prosecuted, that they're going to be prosecuted humanely. So it's a tough issue, and it's like the dog catching the car sometimes. What are you going to do with them now that you have them?
And I guess in a manner of speaking, it can sometimes impose literally a bag limit on what you can and cannot do.
Right. I mean, we had the USNS ship Lewis and Clark out there that we used as basically a holding facility for these pirates, because we had to treat them humanely. This is probably the first time that they've ever seen toilet paper or had three meals a day had anything. So I mean, we gave them dental care, we gave them metal care, we tested them for TB, we did everything in accordance to the human rights treaties and make sure that we treat them with respect and dignity. But the problem is, if you take a small ship that gets out there and captures pirates, where are they going to do them? Where can they hold them? And ships don't have large facilities to hold these people. So getting them on and off, and then where are you going to transfer them? The Gulf of Aden itself is 1.1 million square miles of ocean, which is three times the size of the Gulf of Mexico. So it's a big water space, and so now getting these pirates out, from the water space to the land is a very complicated process.
And let's talk a little bit about that water space. You obviously were dealing with a area of operations that runs up into the Red Sea, around the Horn of Africa, down the Somali coast, and even quite a bit of distance offshore. how big was the arena you and your four or five ships had to cover at any given day?
Right. My area itself that we were, I mean, the Task Force 151, the charter was to patrol the Gulf of Aden. And as I say, it's about 1.1 million square miles of ocean, you know, two-thirds, you know, the size of the United States. So with five warships plus the other coalition warships, you're talking about a total of about 25 warships out there. That's a pretty big area. I mean, just think three-fourths of the United States and you're going to patrol it with, you know, 25 police cars. So it's a lot of area. So one of the things we did when we first got out there, we established an international recognized transit corridor, which is basically a I-66 east-west corridor. So we tried to reduce the water space that these ships are in so we could, you know, keep a close eye out on them. So they were basically steaming in a straight line, falling, you know, in the area of other ships and, you know, and trying to seek protection of the Navy. So that brought down the area, you know, quite substantially that we were patrolling. My biggest concern is you know, we see sequestration in the United States with our maritime forces, and you know, some of the other nations are cutting back on their defense forces and defense budgets. People say, well, maybe piracy. We've won the battle in the Gulf of Aden, and we'll back our forces out. I think if that happens, it's just like the police leaving the streets. You're going to see the piracy pick back up again because they'll just go to the path of least resistance.
Now, in olden days, be it World War I, World War II, or even the age of fighting sail when the East India Company used to go ahead and be the primary merchant, you know, power in the world, we would convoy. In other words, we would gather ships and run scheduled convoys through, unsure or hostile waters. Why was convoying not an option for people like for your force? I mean, did you just simply not have the resources, or is it too much of a problem of trying to herd cats internationally with the various merchant lines?
Well, you know, that's a great point. There's some task forces like the Chinese and the Russian task force. That's exactly what they do, is they do convoys. They put out bulletins, notice to mariners, and say, okay, they will start at Point Alpha, Point Bravo at certain times in, you know, during the day or whatever, you know, give them a latitude and longitude to basically assemble and start convoying, you know, the east and west. We took a look at that, and what the biggest problem with the convoys is number one, the speed of the slowest vessel. We thought that we had a good indication of where the large pirate activity is. Most of the pirates are coming from a port city called Passassa, and they basically, you know, just get in their craft and they say, okay, you know, go straight north and end up in the channels up in there. So we had a good record of where most of the pirate activity. So it's just like, why did, Bonnie and Clyde rob banks? You know, because that's where the money was. So that's where we stayed, where the pirate activity was. But there were some task forces that actually did convoy operations, you know, and whether one was more successful or not, it's hard to say. The other issue is that we had concerns about is if they're not U.S. flag vessel and we're convoying them and somebody, you know, gets hijacked, there may be some legal ramifications. So we just chose to basically keep it in the area where the majority of the pirate activity is and kind of shift our missions out a little bit, you know, whether it's, you know, east or west, and we'd come down there and patrol off the coast and take a look and try to figure out, you know, some of their tactics. But we just felt it was not a good use of resources to do convoy operations.
Now, when we talk about pirate vessels, you know, those of us who've watch far too many Johnny Depp movies, we think of ships that are fairly good sized, well armed, coming out and doing, you know, and grabbing merchant ships. This is not the case here. Talk a little bit about what kind of vessels and weapons are these pirates actually, you know, using to go ahead and to grab these ships.
Right, the vessels that you see predominantly are these skiffs, about 30, 35 foot in length, usually carrying, you know, two outboard motors, and you see in the craft themselves, you'll see, you know, seven or eight suspected pirates. There are thousands of these crafts that are out there. So if you're patrolling around, you see four or five of them together in a suspicious activity type of mode. They don't have fishing nets on board. Then may be a good indication. But like I said, there's thousands of them. There's a lot going on in that water space. There's human smuggling. There's smuggling of drugs. And actually, there are people who are out there fishing. So, but if you see a small craft and they're usually formed together. And they have, the variety of weapons that they'll have. They'll have ladders, grappling hooks, AK-47s and RPGs, and they may have some type of navigation support, but very limited itself. So that's basically what you see out there. And we would love to go out there and search every single one of those crafts, but like I said, there are thousands of them out there, and it'd be very hard. So if you usually saw some that are in looking a suspicious activity, coming along at high speed, it's kind of hard to catch fish at high speed. So if you see four or five of them, steaming towards a ship at high speed, they're probably not out there catching fish. As I said a little while earlier, they changed their tactics, and what they started to do is they'd see that they hijacked these large fishing vessels called dhows, D-A-H-O-W, and they would expand their horizons out into the Indian Ocean and use the dhows also in the Gulf of Aden. So basically, they would hijack these vessels. The Dow gave them a more secure place to operate. They could operate longer and out in deeper oceans.
And on any given day, you might find a given boat fishing or, doing a little, moving of cargo down the coast and doing a little, black marketing or commerce. And the next day, everybody's out with a family AK going out and seeing if they can grab something.
Right, exactly.
Is that a fair statement?
Yes, sir. I mean, like I said, the Somalis are desperate people. They are looking to wait to how to make money, whether it's piracy. Some of them are actually fishing or human smuggling. There's a report, United Nations, that says that in the neighborhood of about 50,000 people leave Somalia a year. They head straight up towards the coast of Yemen, where there are UN refugee camps. So, and of course, they're paying to leave the country. So it's like I said, it's the wild, wild west out there, and there's no Coast Guard out there from the Somali nation to protect their coast. The Yemeni has a few Coast Guard vessels, but not nearly enough to make a dent in what's going on out there.
And this is very much a product of the failed states in the region and people just doing what they have to do to go and obviously make a living, as it were.
Right. They blame they say that they're pirates because of the Western fishermen who have stolen the fish off their country's coast. But I think the it's just an issue of survival for them. They need to make money, and the average Somali may make $50 a month, and if somebody comes and says, okay, we can triple that or quadruple that, if you go out to sea and be a pirate, they'll jump at it because they think that the opportunity exists. The problem is about 50% of the pirates that go to sea don't come back, so it's a rough business, and they most of them are not from the coastline. They're coming from inland there in Somalia and are not familiar with how to swim or anything like that, or to operate at sea. And it, like I said, it's a big ocean, and you're out there in these small craft that don't have navigation, running lights, and things like that. There's a good chance they could be run over by one of these large merchant ships because they're operating in the merchant transit areas.
And let's face it, if you're if you're a 100,000-ton container ship, one of those little fishing vessels may not even show up on the radar.
Exactly.
In the middle of the night.
Right.
So it's not exactly a safe profession, although it does have some lucrative elements, which raises a question. For a lot of operations that you've done in your life, when you've commanded amphibious ships and stood off coast, you basically are doing donuts for weeks at a time, refueling and replenishing every few days off of the ship. But basically, you're doing nothing but passing time. What was the pace of life in CTF 151? Was it another another kind of, you know, passing time thing? Or was it busy? Was it, you said earlier you had a lot of fun doing it, and guys in the Navy who say the word fun, it usually means a very, very high and, shall we say, varietal op tempo.
Right. Well, I guess the good part about it is, you know, we were not being shot at while out there, but it was a pretty high tempo operation, and the reason why, because it seemed like that that there was a lot of activity, you know, standing up the task forces, how the task forces were going to work. There was a lot of pirate activity, so we were, I would say, involved almost daily in either deterring some pirate operation or coordinating with other nations and other navies on going after pirates or you know trying to figure out the pirate tactics. The typical day we may, you know, like I said, we would be, you know, flight operations. I would spend a lot of time working, you know, visiting the coalition ships. I used to try to get over to them, you know, once every other couple of weeks or so, just to see how they worked their operations and their lessons learned, how they got to go. And there were a lot of other coalition ships out there. So I spent a lot of time, you know, going around and visiting the ships. The other dead thing we tried to do is try to get some surveillance on what is happening ashore, you know, with the pirate camps. And at that time, they had a lot of ships that were being held in the pirate camps, and trying to figure out the tactics of what's going on. The other things that we had to be concerned about, of course, is, you know, we didn't, you know, some of these nations, you know, like the Chinese and the Russians, we don't have a circuit that we can communicate with them. So we want to make sure that we, you know, deconfliction and where we were operating and how we were operating, to make sure we didn't have any, accidents, you know, blue on blue force when we were out there.
And I guess for the people who you had in your command, what was life like for the deck plate sailors, the guys who peel the potatoes or maintain the boats, or, I mean, what was the best job out there if you were a sailor? I mean, I think you probably thought you had a pretty good job, but what was the best job out there in your mind?
Oh, without a doubt, it was the boarding teams. And believe me, these young sailors and young officers who were out there boarding these crafts and going out there inspecting boats were having a blast. I mean, when we had our first opportunity that we captured the pirates, and it was just, I mean, these guys were just so overjoyed to go out there and make an arrest at sea, or, you know, apprehend these people. The Hilo detachment teams had a great time, you know, chasing these crafts down. I remember that one of the times that we chased some pirates down that were, you know, suspected pirates that were attacked one of the ships, and we had authority to fire warning shots at them. So this young sailor who was in the back of the helicopter, you know, flying out there and firing warning shots at a craft that's trying to get away from him, you know, when he came back on deck, it was just to see the look on his face, you know, when he said, "Oh, I got to fire the weapon at these," you know, not just putting holes in the water, but trying to stop these people. So I think that most of the teams that were out there, you know, had a great time just being involved, because it was a mission. You know, sometimes you just go out there and whether they're doing 1,000 yards astern watching flight operations, or waiting for the call to, you know, fire Tomahawk missiles that have probably never come, but this was actually a real operation, and they were involved with it day to day.
Now, obviously, you operated under some fairly tight and constrictive rules of operation, rules of engagement. But we also hear that some of the other coalition and national forces were, shall we say, a little less restrictive in their use of live ordnance. We hear stories about the Russians, the Indians, the Turks, not being, shall we say, quite so interested in capture and prosecution. How did these kinds of lethal actions affect what you were doing, trying to deter things and trying to do so in a humane and prosecutorial way?
Well, you know, every time you go out and speak about piracy, everybody always, you know, ask the question, well, you know, why did you waste your time with prosecuting them? Just, you know, we know they're guilty. Just, you know, make them walk the plank. But, you know, the piracy operation, you know, is more of a law at sea, you know, and it's not, you know, pretty much law of armed conflict. So we had to, like I said, we had to make sure that we treated these people humanely. A lot, there's a each nation had their own different rules of engagement. I always tell the story about the Russian model. The Russians captured a bunch of pirates one time and brought them on board the Russian ship and you know, interviewed them, you know, probably gave them, you know, a drink of water and then put them back in their skiff, and the next day they were not there anymore, and the Russians never denied anything about it. You know, their story was they probably just tried to swim ashore, but I think we all know something else probably happened. But you know, it's every nation had their own rules of engagement. Like I said earlier, some nations were just out there to deter piracy. They didn't want to capture them. They didn't want to, you know, prosecute them. Didn't want to bring them on board the ship unless they were going after one of their flag vessels, and then they would figure it out. But predominantly, they would just deter them. So that's what the rules of engagement for most of the countries that are out there is, just to deter piracy, fight them off, and try to avoid, do the best they can to not allow them to board the ships.
Now, you guys obviously had a fairly busy op tempo if you were engaging almost every day. In terms of the time period, 2009, when you were out there, how many attacks against merchant vessels and attempted seizures were there during that time frame? Can you give us a sense of how often you were having to deal with an action of that sort?
Well, if you know, from the data that I have is, you know, in 2009, which was actually 2011 was the peak year with 174 attacks, but 2009 there were 163 attacks, with of which 46 were pirated. So that, you know, so it was about, you know, if you divide that up in 365 days, so there was, you know, a almost an attack a day now, every other day. Now, those are the ones that were reported. Sometimes, you know, these things wouldn't get reported because they weren't sounded. But the actual facts and figures what we had, the pirates actually fired on them, tried to board them. In 2009 was about 163 attacks, and 46 of those were actually pirated. So, like I said, it was 2009 through 2011 were pretty busy years in the pirate activity off the coast of Somalia.
And what is it like today? Can you give us some metrics of what piracy off that piece of water space today is like?
Well, as I said earlier, it's been over a year since a vessel has actually been pirated. In 2013, we're a little over halfway through. There have only been 5 attacks, and 0 vessels have been pirated. So it's been a great success story for the coalition forces, for the support from the United Nations, and some of the other nations that you know, may not provide maritime support, but you know, financial support, you know, to prevent piracy. The biggest problem is, you know, is what's going to happen ashore. We have seen some progress with the Somali government moving towards not a Jeffersonian democracy, but a more functional government. The European Union has put a lot of resources in to, you know, some of the facilities ashore to try to just, you know, say let's look at it. The problem is ashore, so let's try to figure this out. You know, rather than having warship steam out here, you know, 365 days, let's try to do some things ashore to get these people to do something else besides being pirates out there.
Which is obviously a good thing, but by the same token, pirates are everywhere. And where are, I mean, we know, for example, there's never really been a period when in choke points like the Straits of Malacca off of Indonesia, and of course in the Caribbean and other places where there's always been piracy. Where has piracy been growing? And along the model that you were having to fight it, and what kinds of conditions are we dealing with? Are we going to have to go and do the same thing, for example, off Nigeria that we did off the Horn of Africa?
Right. The major spike that we have seen in the last 2 years is off the coast of Nigeria, and it's a different form of pirate and pirate activity. The pirates off the coast of Somalia, basically, they would go after any ship. They just want to get the ships, hijack them, and they're not really concerned about the cargo. The pirates off the coast of Nigeria, They're basically, we know exactly what that cargo is. It's oil. They want the cargo, and they want payment for the cargo. They're ruthless pirates. The pirates off the coast of Somalia are I want to say a friendlier group of pirates, but they basically know if they kill the crew members that it's going to be very hard to get the ransom payments. The same is not true in the Gulf of Nigeria. We've had a lot of activity where they just take over the ship and they're basically ruthless. They kill the crew members or just say, okay, we're going to take over the ship. We still have activity in the Philippines and in the Straits of Malacca, but not as big as a ramp up as we've seen in Nigeria in the last couple of years.
How are we doing down in the Caribbean and down in the Central American neck these days, both the Pacific and the Atlantic side? Obviously this is deeply, deeply tied to the movement of drugs and other contraband cargo by transnational criminal organizations. What is that situation like?
Well, there still is activity down there. I mean, there, especially around the northern part of South America, we see activity. It's not as bad as in other parts of the world, but in the Caribbean, the problem that we're running into is the size of the U.S. Coast Guard with the number of ships that have come down and the number of U.S. Navy ships that are down there operating. So there's great potential to see not only increase in smuggling but piracy, because the size of our navies and our naval forces are just declining, and these people are they're not the smartest people out there, but they understand if there's a warship out there, it's going to be tough, and when there's no warships and nobody just no cops out there to protect the beat, then they'll start the illegal activity, whether it's smuggling or pirating.
Back when I was doing the Marine book, when we first knew each other 2 decades ago, God, doesn't time fly when you're having fun? Chuck Krulak, then the Commandant of the Marine Corps, told me that there was nothing that had a greater deterrent value and stabilizing influence than being able to reach out and touch the hull of a gray-painted U.S. Navy ship in your water space. How influential is that today, and is that still there? Is that magic of a U.S. Navy ship coming into your neck of the woods still a something that goes ahead and calms the waters and the natives?
No doubt. I mean, I just, our history, you go back and read, whether it's, the sand pebbles or anything that we've done, in our Navy history, and the presence of a U.S. Navy warship or any maritime ship, it's just power projection. I know I've heard the Chief of Naval Operations now, saying that, he just doesn't have enough ships but the question is, what is the right mix? There's a lot of debate about the littoral combat ship and the firepower that it provides with the battle group. But there are other missions that the littoral combat ship that can handle that you don't want to put a multi-billion dollar Aegis cruiser out there or an aircraft carrier. So we have to continue to fund to continue to have our Navy strong and influence not only our foreign policy but allow the free flow of commerce throughout the sea. Let's face it. I mean, there's no nation on the globe right now that can prevent a terrorist organization or anything, from restricting a choke point. If you have the pirates, that are going to get out of control in the Gulf of Aden. I mean, there's in the neighborhood of 25,000-30,000 vessels that flow through there a year. So if you stop that major waterway there with the flow of commerce, something's going to happen. So it's very important that our Navy continue to be strong and show the flag throughout the world.
Not that I'm asking a personal opinion as much as I am a question of feasibility. If you had one or two LCS-type ships with modules supportive of a counter-piracy mission, would those have been useful to you, given the current metaphor that the Navy has for LCS?
I think the LCS is the ideal platform four counter-piracy operations. I mean, it's the Absalon, which was in my task force, was a modular type of ship. The problem that we have is that the United States Navy has been providing the command and control flagship for Task Force 151. I don't think that the littoral combat ship has the space to bring on a flagstaff and support, you know, the operations and the command and control. But for doing counter-piracy operations, you know, by itself, I think it would be a great asset. It can do speed and can go, you know, and go out there and chase the pirates. But it has some restrictions on if you don't want it to be the flagship for the task force, I think it'd be perfect out there. But you just have to make sure you send it out there that it can do the mission successfully.
Now, you obviously did this assignment, came home, and there came a time when you retired. And what motivated you to go and write your book for Naval Institute? Let's talk a little bit about your book and the process by which you put it together.
Well, when I was out there, you know, steaming around, I had this thought. I said to ask a major, his name was Tim Watkins, really smart guy. He was on my staff there. I said, could you build me, you know, a 10 or 15 PowerPoint slide brief, you know, rotary style club. So, you know, it's non-classified. You know, I can talk to people about, you know, piracy operations, because this is not, you know, a big, you know, national security issue where we, you know, we have to keep it top secret and, you know, cleared by, you know, the National Security Council. So he did a great job, built me some slides, and I came back, and it was, you know, piracy was the happening thing, and people were willing to listen. So I had the great opportunity to go out and talk, and people, you know, came up to me and said, hey, you know, this is great stuff. You ought to write a book about it. Well, with a lot of encouragement from my wife and my family and some very close friends, I said to myself, well, I'm going to go off and you know, try to write a book. And so with the support of the Naval Institute Press, who has just been monumentally supportive of what I've done in not only producing the book, writing the book, but also getting me out there, you know, talk about the book. And so we went off and wrote the book, and it's been out there. And it, from what the Naval Institute Press is saying, it's selling pretty well, which is good. And it's like, you know, I said earlier about Lloyd's of London making the money with it. So I think maybe if we have a, you know, some piracy pickup, maybe the book sales will pick up. But we don't want to get anybody hurt just to sell the book. but maybe we could get, you know, just a couple big pirates.
No, but there's nothing like a shooting war to sell military books,
right?
That we all know.
You know how that goes, right?
Well, I'm not exactly a merchant of death, but I certainly have gone and made my trade off of conflict in the world in the past few decades. Obviously, you've got a vast reservoir of experience working inshore in your naval career. And what are you going to write about next? What do you have ambitions of another book? Are you going to be writing magazine stuff? Where do you see your writing and, shall we say, evangelical efforts regarding the Navy going now?
Well, I enjoy writing. I've had, like I said, great support from the Naval Institute in their proceedings, and, you know, to get some articles out there, op-ed pieces on not only piracy but also maritime security. So I enjoy doing that. As you know, the big part about writing a book itself is the research, and make sure the research is found. For my book Pirate Alley, I had most of the material there, and we conducted a lot of interviews. So the next topic, whether it's, you know, the history of piracy in the United States Navy or whatever it is, it's going to take a little more time than I have right now. But I definitely, you know, I don't want to, you know, put the brain and the pen to rest. I enjoy the talking about piracy, and I enjoy the elements of maritime security. So I think there's something out there on the horizon. I just got to get my thoughts and facts and figures together and put it all together.
And what kind of message do you want to go and tell people about the Navy and about what we can and what we can do and what we should do these days? I'm going to give you a couple minutes to go ahead and editorialize here. So
sure.
Go for it.
I think, like I've written in my book and also, you know, articles about, You know, Admiral Mullen, when he was the chief of naval operations, you know, he said, you know, we need the 1,000-ship Navy. Of course, when that came out, Congress was sweating. They'd say, how are we going to fund a 1,000-ship Navy? But what he meant by that and what is a great example of how that came to pass is the working with coalition forces, you know, across boundaries, working together with them in, you know, in the maritime environment. And that's an example of what happened in the Gulf of Aden to fight piracy is, you know, a monumental story of how successful it was. I mean, every quarter the Naval Central Command has a meeting they get all these coalition forces together and they bring them in to Bahrain and they talk about the issues. And I mean, this is cross boundaries. They invite everybody in the region to come in there and, you know, to discuss counter piracy, you know, smuggling of drugs or whatever it is out there. You know, and it's been a great success for it. So I think that is going to be the model. The issue is that, and I, you know, I stress at a ton of time that, you know, if you go back and look at Mahan's great book of, you know, the influence of sea power, our nation has got to maintain a strong Navy. And we have to lead it. And, you know, we just cannot, you know, we can't, you know, continue to cut our budgets. And then one day we look around and we just don't have a strong Navy to prepare ourselves, you know, to if we have a case in the Straits of Hormuz, you know, in the Suez Canal or something, with the evacuation of our citizens in an embassy somewhere with our Marine forces to be able to do that. So we have got to continue to fund and maintain a strong maritime force and the Coast Guard too. I can't forget the Coast Guard because, you know, we are, I mean, you just look at some of the areas of our coast our coasts are huge. And they've got some waters out there. We've got some, you know, some territorial waters out in the Pacific and, you know, that just way out there in the Marshall Islands, you know, places like that. And we have to continue to monitor whether it's, you know, fishery patrols or piracy or smuggling of drugs or people. So it's just we are a maritime nation and we need to maintain our maritime forces in a robust manner.
Admiral, I want to thank you for having the patience to come on, much less come on a second time. I know our listeners are really happy that you came on and gave us a chance to talk to you, and I hope we have reason to bring you on again someday.
Good. Okay, well, John, well, thanks very much, and I appreciate all your support for the military. That's all you've done for these so many years, and I look forward to talking to you with you, and maybe we could work on a book together sometime.
Might be fun, sir. It might be. And with that, I want to end on a personal note. One of the great American war heroes, and when I use that word hero, I mean a real one, not someone who just showed up, but someone who showed up again and again and again and personified the words above and beyond the call of duty passed yesterday. Colonel Bud Day, Medal of Honor winner, POW in Vietnam, absolutely a role model for a lot of great Americans in the military and out, passed away yesterday down in Florida. And I just want to go and say thanks for being there for us all, Bud, and rest in peace, buddy. You are an amazing individual. And that's it for Military Monday today. We'll be back at 1 p.m. next Monday. Please come by and give us a listen. Thank you.